Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disabilities who have taken from them or are denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those above them. Disrespect welcomes Professor Peter Grafe, who studies social policy at McMaster and is a professor in political science here. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
We were going to talk about how people can evaluate the benefits that they might be going to get and the light in which we can view McGuinty's budget.
That's right. Well, I mean, there wasn't much in it, ultimately. I mean, for people who are on social assistance or on disability, it was 2%, so pretty much inflation.
When does that happen?
November and December, respectively. I guess November for the ODSP, December for OW. And so, essentially, it's an inflationary increase, more or less, pretty much like
2%
we've seen.
This last month, food prices have gone up a fortune.
And you could say utilities, too, are kind of trending upwards. So, yeah, maybe it won't be quite inflation. So, essentially, what you've got is, I mean, McGuinty took the cap off that we had under Harris, where there wasn't any increase from about 95. And he's more or less put it on the track for general inflation. But you're right, in terms of utilities, food, core essentials, it may not be quite caught up there. Yeah. Now, they like to say they've done more because they've passed through a bit of the National Child Benefit supplement payments that had been clawed back before. But, you know, again, you have to have kids to touch that. And even there, the amounts aren't great. So, I mean, it's a 2%. And then the continued rollout of the Ontario Child Benefit, which started in the last budget. Obviously, there were some issues around that, around things like the snowsuit fund and the back-to-school allowance that have been fought about over the past year.
But progress there, right?
Not a great deal. I mean, I think they've been trying to work some of that out, but I mean, again, it's not like it's kind of you get a bit more money on a monthly basis through the Ontario Child Benefit, but if you're spending that because your income is less than your monthly expenses, yeah, obviously you don't have the chance to have that when you need it in big chunks. Yeah, I think you've got a provincial government that doesn't really believe in social assistance. They believe in that you can somehow take kids out of families and give them transfers that are going to push them above a level. And so in that kind of thinking, you want to take the money out of the sort of social assistance system where it's tied to specific and predictable events like, you know, back to school or you need to get winter clothes, which are expensive once a year when the winter comes, and just think that somehow you can just push this money onto the kids. And I think that's the idea of this Ontario Child Benefit too, which they've, you know, they lightly enriched in the budget. That you can send that out to all kids. You know, this kind of far-fetched idea that the benefits for kids, if you take them outside of social assistance, makes it easier for parents to move into the work, that there won't be so much of a penalty. But, I mean, ultimately, that's a bit, you know, it's probably a bit of a misrepresentation of the life situation of people on social assistance, right? Sort of it's making assumptions about work ethic and so on, which are unfounded. But, I mean, I think that's the logic of the government, and that's why it's 2%. And that's why in their strategy to reduce child poverty by 25% over the next 5 years was based, I think, in their thinking entirely on the idea that if you bump up the Ontario Child Benefit, if you finish the increase in minimum wages, they aren't making any promises beyond 1075, but if you bring that up, you force the federal government, to double the working income tax benefit and you get them to increase the National Child Benefit Supplement, you're going to take a certain small section of kids, probably whose parents you would count among the working poor, and you're just going to push them above the line. And that's their anti-poverty strategy in a nutshell. It's got really nothing there for people on social assistance in terms of changing the adequacy of benefits, of reducing the sort of number of restrictive rules that make it a really bad program, a poor program for poor people. There's not anything in this anti-poverty strategy, and we've seen it again in this budget, that really addresses social assistance in a core manner. To date, their poverty reduction strategy has all been about taking a small number of kids and trying to just, who are close to the line that they define, and just pushing them over through a number of these income support programs like the child benefit.
So here's the right-wing love of quantifiable results. And, you know, it's not enough to say we've accomplished something wonderful. It's better to say we accomplished enough, and here's the proof, basically. The Liberals, you know, more than the other parties, have a very definite division between a right and a left wing. And there seems to be a feeling that either the poor don't vote, or the gross domestic product of the province is a pie, and the more the poor get, the less everybody else gets, which isn't borne out when the IMF recommended that putting money in the hands of the poor was one of the best ways to stimulate the economy, because it's all spent immediately too. So these guys aren't even doctrinaire right-wingers. They're Harris conservatives.
Well, I think at a certain point you've got a provincial Liberal Party that looked at what Harris did, saw that there was some social fallout from that, and their goal is to contain that, not to bring any kind of sense of justice, not to really increase equality, but in a sense to try and mop up some of the worst forms of exclusion so that you can continue with the core
conservative
agenda. But, you know, where you don't have to walk over if you're, a businessman in downtown Toronto, don't have to, if you could put all the homeless people into jail, so much the better, I'm sure, in their view. But since that's, not going to be an effective solution, are there ways that you can do some things around the margins to make poverty a bit less galling, a bit less open, a bit less evident? So, there's that. I think the other side is they have this idea that in the long run, the competitiveness of Ontario is going to suffer if kids aren't looked after when they're really young. Now, they don't actually want to transfer the resources or give access to opportunity in a full sense that you might, put forward as a form of social justice, but they somehow get the sense that child poverty is expensive. And so you've got to do something about it, although not something that would cause you to raise taxes. And so I think that's why when they put out a poverty reduction strategy, you see a lot of bric-a-brac around an Ontario child benefit. You see a number of small programs in schools in lower-income neighborhoods. I think, again, it's based on their thinking that we've got to do something about poor children, but an unwillingness to actually spend the money to do something significant, to kind of recognize, well, you've got poor children because you've got poor parents, and you've got neighborhoods which, systematically are going to be poor in opportunities. Yeah. And so that, in a sense, you're still going to get a situation where kids growing up in certain areas are going to have access to no end of opportunities to be all they can be because their parents can afford to develop the services. But, if you go into downtown Hamilton, for instance, you've got a lot of bright people, a lot of innovative thinking, but you just don't have the resources there to provide those kids with all the opportunities that they would, say, in a suburban school. And, I don't get the sense that McGuinty is about really opening the doors of opportunity fully to them. But I think it's enough one saying, well, we can't afford to write off all these kids, and so we have to, do something or another, and so they come up with these small programs. So I think there's a recognition that there's a problem they have to address, but they're not willing to address it in a full manner because that would involve raising taxes or doing other things which they're more committed to. In other words, lowering taxes is a bigger commitment for them, I would think, from all that we can see, than to actually take some more substantial steps to try and reduce inequality or increase access to opportunities for all Ontarians to, develop themselves to their full potential.
You could argue, I suppose, that the lack of urban initiative to redevelop is a sore point in the McGuinty budget. It shows that they're not really thinking systemically at all in that regard. But you could take the other point of view too, and I know a writer who's living in Fort Erie right now who would argue, I'm sure, that the poor are together for a reason, and that's that they, to whatever extent, without any government support, they can support one another. They can provide the services, the babysitting exchange, and you know, I don't have kids is why I'm laughing, but you know, all the things that, that people who are poor who can't pay for things need to exchange those things with one another. And if you separate them, as they seem to be doing in Toronto, by shipping them out to the edges of the city, you make it uneconomic to support them. And so there doesn't seem to be an easy answer to this ghettoization problem except to remove the real barrier, which is a lack of income for food and shelter. There doesn't seem to be any. Do you agree?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you try to, you know, you define a population as something and then try to act on them, you're not treating them as people. And in that kind of situation with their complex networks and needs and relationships. And then you can lead to situations like we have seen in Toronto where you get shipped out to areas where they lack the social networks. And we've seen some pretty sad results from that to date if we think of some of what John Clark has been talking out of the OCAP about the result of some of these housing initiatives.
Yeah. Well, the shrinkage of support seems to be parallel to the offering of accommodation on the fringes. So it is a real, as you mentioned, it's a real attempt to remove bodies from the street so that visitors to the center city can't see them.
And I mean, you know, the net result of that in terms of alleviating poverty or opening opportunity is pretty negligible, right?
In fact, it probably increases poverty because you take these people away from their supports and then they become the people that you hear about in the paper, that the superintendent gets a call that somebody hasn't been seen for 5 days and they have to come up and clean up the apartment and ship out the body and that kind of thing. I don't want to be melodramatic, but I mean, when there are no supports and you can't afford to do anything about your situation, what do? You sit there, you know, you sit there and maybe your situation gets so bad that you die. I don't know.
Well, I mean, again, I think if you're talking from the point of view of government strategy, if the government strategy is that we've got these poor people and we're going to have really targeted strategies for those on the margins, I think you're going to end up with really marginal policy that doesn't have much impact on them. I mean, really, I think the problem is that we haven't been thinking about how do we change our mainstream institutions in our society so that we don't create such large margins. I mean, there will always be people who, for whatever reason, have really complex lives and you'll need specialized programming or ways of interacting with them to support them with all those difficulties. But
well,
I mean, part of the problem is
they don't even have to be complex.
That,
if you can give them the one thing that's missing or the couple of things that are missing in their lives, and then they can do the, I mean, I don't see why they should if they're disadvantaged to begin with, but I mean, worst case, they can take advantage of the extra resources and organize their lives to sustain their health and sustain their social networks and their supports. You know?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's why you have to deal with the mainstream institutions of society so that they don't create those margins, because I would agree that, you know, for the vast majority of people, if we had a labor market that worked and produced stable jobs that paid living wages, if we had a series of income support systems that didn't police people in the same way and create a whole series of difficulties for people to figure out what their strategies would be for dealing with whatever life course situations they have, if we had a childcare system that made it much easier to balance caring and work, as well as a series of other supports for people who've had to deal with violence and other forms of abuse in their lives, then I suspect we wouldn't be having the same discussion about social assistance. There's a downside and there's an upside, as you point out. I mean, there's forms of mutual aid and interaction that people who, you know, have had to develop as survival mechanisms. But behind that, too, is, I think, something that we could see see more of in the sense of people developing means of reciprocity and sharing. Now, there's a whole kind of side of material deprivation that's pushing people to do that, right?
Yeah.
You know, a lack of access to sufficient financial resources so that you have to engage in forms of, you know, sharing babysitting, giving haircuts, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, there's a positive side to that that's been lost in places where people, you know, just buy everything and don't know their neighbors and so on. So, I mean, there's kind of two sides to it, but that's not to create a kind of, you know, as I say, I'm not creating some kind of idealized vision of being poor because, I mean, again, that's coming from a lack of opportunity, deprivation, insufficient funds for living. But, you know, I think in a sense there's aspects that come from that sort of form of sharing that we might be worth thinking about. How could we generalize them too to the mainstream, right? How could we ensure that more people have the opportunity to set up arrangements of sharing, of neighborliness, of figuring out how to solve problems together? I mean, it's a shame that, you know, it has to take place in a situation where people are doing it because ultimately they don't have much in the way of other choices if they want to make ends meet, or in many cases not making ends meet, but, you know, come a bit closer to that kind of goal.
You know, as you talk, one of the things that comes home to me, and I have not thought about this before, so it may not be at all profound, is that when you take the poor people out of the neighborhood where their supports are, you simply put them in a situation where the advantages of the people around them are ever more intimidating and appear unattainable. I wonder if what you need to do is bring prosperous people into the poor neighborhoods in the form of service offerings and so forth, so that Johnny, who's single mom, has four kids and lives alone on provincial benefits, can actually get to meet a doctor, to meet these people who are better paid than the people in the community in which he lives now, and see that these lives are possible, and talk to these people about how they came about, you know? Because I know, you know, you grow up middle class, maybe you grow up in the suburbs, there's a paucity of social interaction that really is a penalty you pay for growing up in a place so isolated. But, you know, the neighbors have all kinds of goals and aims that they have in part realized, and so you realize these are attainable, and you can conceive your own, and you can pursue them. But if you grow up where these things don't exist, yeah, you develop the social skills, very important the further down the ladder that you go, no less important at the top, but you don't get to meet the people who've actually made their dreams happen for them, or made some dreams happen for them, or even lucked into some kind of line of work that they realized they were well suited for and enjoy. It doesn't happen in these little ghettos. And I don't know how you would entice people like that into these communities except by propinquity of services that employ, you know, professionals or paraprofessionals who have shown the ability to conceive a plan for their lives and to pursue it and to help make it come true.
I suppose, although, I mean, you know, a number of those professionals are in those neighborhoods, and, you know, sometimes it works well in the sense of working together to realize goals and a sort of sharing of sort of skills and expertise that some people who have gone on to develop these professions have in terms of being able to do healthcare or other forms of organization. But in other times, I mean, these professionals are really seen as outsiders who are there looking down on the population. Doctors sometimes, you know, are the sort of the healer from outside who's coming in and looks down the nose at the people who are there. So,
yeah.
I mean, it's part of, I mean, there's a possibility there, always a danger of areas gentrifying at the same time and people being pushed out.
Yeah, that's true.
So there's possibilities, but on the other side, sometimes these people will come in and not work in a kind of democratic spirit, but will come in with a kind of an elitist sense that there's the successful ones, and they'll look down their nose. Or it's a profitable one. I mean, you'll go and see some doctors who do very well, because you can probably process a large number of people through your clinic in an area or receive some sort of benefit for serving in an underserviced area. I don't want to cast aspersions here, because there's a lot of people, a lot of health professionals who are committed to forms of social justice or equality or democracy in their work. But, you know, it's not quite as easy as bringing those people in. But it's true that, I mean, we probably could do a lot more in our public school system to reduce that kind of class differential, both in terms of access to services. I mean, I had a colleague
even
speaking
locating
about
the schools, if they were on the boundaries between areas like that.
Yeah. But even the financing. I mean, someone I knew, you know, their school raises in the six figures, like over $100,000 a year, which, you know, provides for their sort of upper middle class school a whole series of, you know, banned opportunities or activities that are just not going to be available in an inner city school. They're much better at advocating with the board to get services than the parents of an inner city school. So there's things we could do even in terms of our public school system. But if you look across the West, most countries will have a kind of ongoing, you could call it class differential in educational outcomes, where people's class background gets reproduced. If you come from a working class background, you're going to end up in working class jobs. You're not going to do as well in school as kids from the middle class. Is it because those kids are stupid? No, it's because they haven't had the same access to opportunities. The manner they've been taught has been such that it hasn't developed their full range of potentials. And so I think what you see is that in all countries you've got this problem, but some it's less pronounced. But in Canada, it's still pretty high.
We'll take a break now from Peter Grafe and Shake It Up with Kenny Blues Boss Wayne, Thin Line.
Determine which way I move tonight. In line, I ain't walking that line no more. I'll choose left or right now, 'cause I'm tired of keeping score. I stay in the middle, don't move left or right. It's hard for me to determine which way I'm tonight. In line, I ain't walking that line no more. I'll choose left or right now, 'cause I'm tired of keeping score.
You've been listening to Professor Peter Grafe of McMaster University and the 25 and 5 Anti-Poverty Program talk about the McGuinty provincial budget in 2009.
So what could we do in terms of, you know, the schools are one public institution, but we could probably think across them. What are we doing in our hospitals and our healthcare system? Are we actually doing more in areas where you've got a more complex set of problems related to poverty and, you know, all the health things that are related to that, as we've seen in some recent reports. Are we doing more with that, or do we just have situations where the rich and the upper middle class get rich services and, you know, get to go into nicely appointed clinics, you know, still not wonderful, you know, hospitals, but and where people who are living in poverty have access to poor services?
Toronto has St. Mike's, which is kind of interesting because it's on the margins between some very poor residential areas and the high-end business area downtown. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that benefits them. They have that strong Catholic religious affiliation, which seems to benefit them fundraising. Bless the Catholic sense of community there, I guess. But they also seem to be very proactive fundraising, like literally fundraising. I was in their hospital a couple of years ago, and I saw a stack of checks on a desk. I was inquiring about getting some envelopes and whatnot and forms for submitting donations. And the few checks that I could catch a glimpse of were $10, $15, $20, that kind of thing. And clearly there are people who every month just send in a little bit, but there are a lot of them, and they support the hospital's leading edge work in all kinds of areas, including heart care and care of the indigent and the poor. There's that boundary issue again, where it seems locating on a boundary can, with the right incentive, can lead an organization to tap the resources of one area and the needs of another and produce a world-leading capability out of the linking of the two. But we so rarely see that. I mean, here's Hamilton going to establish its own children's hospital out in the residential no man's land, McMaster, which is vacated every summer by students who are childless by and large. And you have to wonder, what's Hamilton's plan to bring health care to the masses? Certainly we have St. Joseph's, which is downtown.
But up on a hill.
Yeah, that's up on a hill, yeah, for sure. I guess, again, these are all things that have been left out of the budget, not in terms even of action, but in terms even of thought. There's no mention that we considered this, but we turned it down, and we're looking at that, and maybe soon, or we've made a first step towards something else. It's just like, well, here's the money. I'm sorry it's not much, but, you know, business needs us.
I think you're right that there wasn't much in the way of thinking about how we could build a stronger and more inclusive province in this budget. Sure, it's about going into deficit in the next few years, but it wasn't about, well, how can we encourage forms of innovative activity, some of the ideas that you had about how you might set up new forms to take advantage of these boundary effects. We talked about social entrepreneurship. We could talk about measures to enhance adequacy of social assistance benefits. I mean, there was a push by the 25 and 5 Network for a $100 a month healthy food supplement. And I think that's going to give rise to an ongoing campaign with some Board of Health officials around the province, because there's a nutritious food basket which they have to come up with, and quite clearly benefits don't cover that, and so there's going to be a push on that. But again, that wasn't in the budget. There wasn't really a lot of imagination in it. And beyond trying to save some auto jobs and some forestry jobs, in a city like Hamilton, there's not a lot there in terms of, well, what's our employment future? Mm-hmm. We've got a lot of people with skills in bashing metal and making metal, mm-hmm. which are important skills, but quite clearly there's no plan to save the steel industry and the knock-on in those. And there was, you know, but a pittance for retraining and for skill development. So even
I didn't notice that.
I think it was like $35 million or something like that, which sounds like a big sum of money, but when you spread it across the number of people who are being thrown out of work across the province as a whole.
Yeah, from Sault Ste. Marie to Hamilton, right.
You know, including it just kind of a normal churn too, with jobs disappearing and people getting training. You know, that's not a lot of money, and it doesn't seem like there's a whole lot of a vision behind, you know, how you build. And so what's the outcome of that? Well, the outcome of that is, I think, you've got more people falling towards the minimum wage for whatever job they're doing, which, again, is not creating an inclusive society. It's not working to shore up the mainstream institutions, but just letting them go so that we end up with ever larger margins of people who are either working poor, or even if they just get over the line so they no longer qualify as working poor, have a a much more limited set of options in front of them in terms of being able to be all that they can be, ultimately, of developing their skills and capacities, and the skills and capacities of their communities, too. Because if you're working at a minimum wage job, you're not going to have the time and energy to be doing the kind of community things that at one time gave so much meaning in life to, you know, what your life was, because you had, you know, vibrant sporting leagues, and you had, you know, vibrant, you know, within the religious institutions, you know, more in the way of men's clubs and women's clubs and so on. So there's a whole series of knock-on effects when you just let the margins grow, because people living on the edge don't have the time to contribute as richly as they would like to, and to develop their capacity to work in their community as much as they'd like to, because they're ultimately in a bit of a survival strategy mode. I mean, I don't want to over-exaggerate it.
No,
I mean, people
not. I don't think that's an exaggeration.
Have find richness and quality and meaning in their lives. You know, so I don't want to, you know, sort of overdo it.
But they could find more richness and quality and meaning if they had a little more time.
Yeah, and beyond the individual, too, would have time, I think, too, to help develop aspects of community, which, you know, are lost. I mean, this is across the income spectrum, because even, you know, well into the middle class, you've got a decrease of people who have time to do community work. But again, those kind of core aspects of the mainstream. So labor markets, jobs that pay good wages, and then a series of social supports that allow citizens to deal with the crises and dislocations in their lives, whether it's ill health, whether it's losing a job, whether it's acquiring a disability, you know, any number of things that predictably happen to us when we live in society. It's part of the risk of living in society. But if we had a set of supports that insured people against that, that allowed them to deal with those situations, then I don't think we'd be talking in the same way about social assistance, because we wouldn't have that. That same mass. I mean, again, there's some people whose lives are going to be so complex because of, you know, disabilities, abuse, and so forth, that those would be insufficient. You'd need some sort of more specialized supports and helping them. But then it would be a much easier situation, in a sense, because you'd be dealing with a much smaller group of people, and you would have dealt with this kind of this mass that we have of poverty. I mean, it's not a law that we have to have 17% poverty in Ontario. It's not physics.
Is it 17%?
I think in the last census, so maybe it may have been about 14-15% for Ontario as a
and
whole,
climbing.
And 17 in Hamilton.
Okay.
Well, it was down lightly from, you know, the early 2000s, because we had a nice period of economic growth, but just down an iota. And the Ontario Association of Food Banks has predicted that it's going to go up province-wide about 3-4% as a result of this recession. So in Hamilton, we could be looking at a poverty rate of about 20%, 21% when this recession.
One in five.
Would be living below what they call the low-income cutoff. So people who are experiencing hardship in terms of paying rent and feeding themselves, and then having funds for everything else that we have to do, like heating our apartments or buying clothes and so on.
Yeah. I'm outside of my vocabulary now, but is it fair to use the word geopolitical to describe the ghettoization of the poor and the deprivation of opportunity that comes with it? Is it, in fact, a territorial urban issue concern?
I mean, I think we do see, we could say there was a geography to this, right? I mean, in a sense that, I mean, often we'll define poverty in terms of incomes, but that's just, I mean, it's a handy indicator. But in a sense, I think poverty is an exclusion from the full opportunities available in society. And those exclusions do often have a really strong clustering in neighborhoods. Now, this isn't to kind of take a neighborhood like some people in Hamilton are prone to do and say, oh, look at Beasley, and here's, you know, a terrible place, or it's full of danger and so on. But, I mean, I don't think it takes too much to think about how someone growing up in that neighborhood may have a tougher time getting access to the series of recreational activities or activities in schools that allow them to explore what their skills are, what their interests in the world are, that kids would get in some other neighborhood. And similarly for adults, their capacity even just to move around, people's capacity to be mobile, to have access to, you know, interesting natural settings, capacity to have access to recreation, to get to jobs, to get to different forms of training and thinking, different public services are going to be limited by geography. in that way, and neighborhoods have an impact. And when we see in city after city things like inner city schools closing down, you get a loss of those kind of public spaces and public resources that do provide people that opportunity. So, yeah, I mean, I think there is something that's profoundly geographical or neighborhood-based or rooted in space that does serve. And, I mean, that's something else that was absent in this budget, if you get right down to it. There had been some promise of, I think it was $20 million to put into different forms of community entrepreneurship. Now, there's problems with community entrepreneurship in some ways. But, you know, money that would go into community organizations that spring up, that respond to the demands and interests of localities where people in neighborhoods get together and say, look, we've got a need that's not being met here, and we can think up new ways of doing it, I mean, is, you know, it's not a panacea. I mean, it's still important to move money around, to move resources, to ensure that people have adequate incomes. But one thing that, you know, governments could do is provide more resources to communities to set their own goals and priorities, and to develop organizations to deal with them, because not only are you developing services, you're developing the capacities within there of people's ability. Because, I mean, I can't plan my way. I can plan a 3-car funeral, right? I don't have that. But if I had to plan those for a while, I could probably figure out how to do it. And so similarly, to allow communities to develop the skills to plan, to recognize needs, and to innovate is important. And I think that was an element of the Liberal promises to develop some kind of fund like that. It wasn't in the budget. And in fact, we see a lot of these local organizations were already really worn down by all the demands that have been placed on them, increasing needs, increased competition for scarce funds. In the current recessionary period, they're probably having a much tougher time finding money from donors. People who use the services are cash-strapped or unable to pay for them. So while there was, you know, money to bail out the auto sector, money to bail out different parts of the economy, there was no money in this budget to support this important community infrastructure, which is important in allowing communities to develop their own ideas and their own programs and their own responses to crisis. So that's another thing that's missing.
And which is also taking up a lot of the government's role. I mean, these organizations save the governments tons of money. I asked a cook at the Salvation Army, who had been there for decades, to see. A couple of months ago, I said, what are you going to do if the need for feeding people rises by 50% over the next year? And all she could say was, God will provide. Bless her heart. But I think even a religious person would argue that God likes to see some initiative too, you know? And the Liberals haven't provided it.
Yeah, I think you're right here. Because, in fact, a lot of what we have that may be useful social programs originated out of communities organizing for themselves and then demanding that the state take it on as a right that we should all have access to.
Yeah, that's true. Is it fair, then, if you're looking for a 10 words or less sum up of what's wrong, and we've gone to great lengths to show that there are other ways to sum this up, is it fair to say that a lack of consideration for community is the hallmark of this McGuinty budget, then, of its shortcomings?
Yeah, I think that would be not a bad way of summing it up.
Is there anything else that you wanted to say?
No, I think we've done a kind of good tour of that. You know, this is a budget that is not about building an inclusive Ontario. It's a budget that sees a recession, says, well, we're going to have to go into deficit, maybe help a couple of key sectors. But, again, there's not much there for the rest. I mean, look at the harmonized sales tax. The Realtors Association got all upset that the, you know, new house buyers would have to pay an extra tax, and they got an exemption up to $400,000 and a reduction until $500,000. It certainly doesn't seem like people living in poverty in Ontario had anywhere near the same leverage. And so I think an issue then is how do we mobilize politically to put pressure on this government and say it's you know, if you can save the realtors so that people don't have to pay just quite as much tax when they're buying a fancy new home out in the suburbs, well, surely you can do a bit more than 2% on the social assistance check.
So people who want to learn more about the 25 and 5, where do they go? They go on the web?
Yeah, if you have access to the web, it would be 25and5.ca, so 25in5.ca. Would be the most logical place to go. I don't have a phone number for the local group, but certainly going through the campaign for adequate welfare and disability benefits in here in Hamilton would be another way to get involved with organizing.
Can you Google that too? Yeah.
I would guess.
Meeting schedules.
Yeah. I would think so. I mean, they meet regularly down at First Pilgrim United Church. So if you were to get a telephone and call down there, they could probably tell you, I believe it's Tuesdays, but be worth checking before showing down on Tuesday for the meeting.
Well, and he probably won't mind, but you could contact Wei Robinson, who seems to be a kind of honorary information exchange about poverty in Hamilton all by himself. And he's heavily involved in the CAWDV at Weyr, W-E-Y-R, at hwcn.org. Weyr at hwcn.org. Thanks, Peter.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to Professor Peter Graef of McMaster University and the 25 and 5 Anti-Poverty Program talk about the McGuinty Provincial Budget in 2009. Perhaps you remember last broadcast I spoke to you about the need for listener support in maintaining a new disability humor segment of the show. I wasn't kidding, but I can tell you're intimidated. Let me tell you, I got into this show when somebody dared me to come up with the disability news, and I had no idea what disability news was, but I decided I might as well go and find out. And in the same spirit, I think it would be good for you, good for me, good for the show, and you'd like to hear your name on the radio, wouldn't you? If you would come up with some disability humor and forward it to us here at Disrespect Dialogue at radio.fm, D-I-A-L-O-G-U-E, the British spelling, dialogue at radio.fm. Now the news. We have very little time. I'm going to rustle through it, and you can sort it out. The Globe and Mail, Tuesday, March the 31st. McGuinty retracts minimum wage musings. Premier chastened after suggesting he might abandon a pledge to increase incomes for the province's lowest paid workers. He apparently had a change of heart over the weekend. I think clearly we owe them fairness, he said in the legislature, referring to why workers struggling to make ends meet at minimum wage jobs should receive the increase. Those comments did not end the matter for New Democratic leader Andrea Horvath, however, who accused the Premier of causing plenty of worry among low-wage earners with his flip-flopping and of not being able to make up his mind. Interim Progressive Conservative leader Bob Runciman accused the Premier of speaking off the top of his head and ignoring a commitment outlined in his government's own budget just the Thursday before, which reiterated a pledge made in 2007 to increase the minimum wage every year until 2010. Quote, it certainly calls into question his competence, Mr. Runciman told reporters. He misspoke, to say the least. Andre Picard, The Globe and Mail, Health Section, Thursday, April 2nd. Disability is not a reason to send a person to jail. On Tuesday night, on the grounds of the Ontario Legislature, a group of community living activists and former residents of institutions gathered for a candlelight vigil. They were celebrating a historic moment in the evolution of health and social welfare systems that occurred when, on March 31st, Ontario closed the last three large institutions for people with developmental disabilities. It was a time not too long ago when there was no place in society for cripples, retards, and crazies, to use once common pejoratives. Psychiatric patients and those with physical disabilities have been largely deinstitutionalized over the past few decades, but those with developmental, or if you prefer, intellectual disabilities such as Down syndrome and Fragile X syndrome, have to a certain extent been forgotten in the push for social justice and equality. While Ontario has closed its institutions, and British Columbia did so years ago, there are several thousand people with developmental disabilities across Canada still residing in large, sterile facilities, such as the Michener Centre in Red Deer, Alberta, the Manitoba Developmental Centre in Portage-la-Prairie, Hôpital Rivière-des-Prairies in Montreal, and Sunset Adult Residential Centre in Pugwash, Nova Scotia. There is no one-size-fits-all alternative to institutional life, but rather many programs and approaches, all with one overarching goal, community living. There's also a need, given the shocking number of people with developmental disabilities who are still warehoused and denied full citizenship in most provinces, to honor what Ontario has done, no matter how overdue. Mentally ill teens lose lifeline, Hamilton Spectator, Saturday, March the 28th. Cornerstone program closing. Until Kevin Schneider started going to the Cornerstone program at McMaster Children's Hospital, he always had trouble at school. When he was faced with something difficult in class, the 17-year-old would retreat into the hallway and sit curled in a ball for hours. 2 years ago, he had a breakdown that prevented him from leaving his bed for weeks at a time. He was referred to Cornerstone, a day treatment program for teens who suffer from psychiatric and emotional problems. It was the first time in his entire school career that I felt people understood his condition and supported him, said his mother, Glenna Wilson. Last week in March, Hamilton Health Sciences announced that Cornerstone will close at the end of this school year. The 25 youths currently involved in the program are waiting to find out where they'll get help in the future. The program, which has been running for 17 years, was funded by the Ministry of Children and Youth Services and the Ministry of Education. Two Hamilton-Wentworth District School Board teachers worked there. Dr. Rod Evans, the medical director of McMaster's Child and Youth Mental Health Program, said the decision to close Cornerstone was made by a team of hospital managers, the school board, and the Ministry of Children and Youth Services. Cornerstone didn't fit into the hospital's reorientation of its mental health programs. The $617,000 cost of the program did not factor into the decision. For Wilson, Cornerstone's closure would mean losing the only program that helped your son. I don't know where I'm going to turn, she said. For those of us who had tried everything, doctors, specialists, schools, it was like a pot of gold. And that from Emma Riley at The Spec. Globe and Mail, late March. Paramedic raises question about victims' care. Sikansky was dead when worker arrived more than 10 minutes after tasering by RCMP. Alan Machak and his partner arrived more than 10 minutes after four RCMP officers confronted Mr. Sikansky in the early morning of October 14, 2007, and stunned him multiple times with a taser. What was your impression about his state of being? Asked Art Vertlieb, a lawyer for the inquiry. Mr. Sikansky was dead, Mr. Machak replied. Mr. Machak and his partner, with the help of firefighters and two additional paramedics who arrived later, performed CPR on Sikansky for nearly an hour before officially declaring him dead. Machiak's testimony raised more questions about how the officers cared for Sikansky after he fell to the ground and lost consciousness. The supervising RCMP officer, Corporal Benjamin Monty Robinson, has insisted he monitored Sikansky's condition after he was shocked and handcuffed. Corporal Robinson told the inquiry that when he turned Mr. Sikansky over to firefighters about a minute and a half before paramedics arrived, he was breathing and had a pulse. But firefighters earlier told the inquiry Sikansky wasn't breathing and they could detect no heartbeat when they reached the scene before the paramedics. Corporal Robinson also told the inquiry Sikansky was snoring, which Mr. Machiak said could have been a sign of airway problems. The corporal testified that after noticing the snoring, he moved Sikansky onto his side. However, firefighters and Machiak have said Sikansky was lying flat on his stomach when they arrived. Machiak's partner, Mike Egli, said when he arrived, the firefighters didn't appear to be doing anything to help Mr. Sikansky aside from checking his pulse. He said the firefighters should have noticed the cyanosis and started giving him oxygen immediately. That by James Keller in Vancouver. This by Jane Armstrong in Vancouver. Family of BC shooting victim plan to sue Vancouver police. The daughters of a homeless man who was shot dead by Vancouver police say their father was a peace-loving activist who was not potentially dangerous, as officers have suggested. The shooting shocked residents because it occurred in broad daylight on a busy downtown street. Witnesses provided different accounts from the police version of the shooting. One man, Adam Smolchek, who said he filmed the incident on his cell phone, said the victim did not advance on the police. Mr. Smolchek also said he thought four shots were fired at the man. Mr. Smolchek claimed an officer took his cell phone while he was still taping the incident and erased the material. Attempts to restore the video to Mr. Smolchek's phone have failed. An Abbotsford police inspector is leading a team of Vancouver police officers investigating the shooting. Abbotsford police spokesman Constable Casey Vinay said the police have talked to about 70 witnesses so far. They also have two surveillance videos from the scene. Constable Vinay said he wouldn't comment on the investigation or lawsuit, but added, "We know that people have questions about the shooting." More details demanded on police taser use. Updated report on stun guns, still too vague, says Toronto Police Board. No name on this one. The civilian body overseeing Toronto Police is asking the force for more details about the 179 times officers tasered people last year, including two 15-year-olds. Pam McConnell, who led the Toronto Police Services Board meeting yesterday, said she's proud Toronto Police disclosed tasering information, but acknowledged several facets of its recent report on use of the stun gun are vague and misleading. More than one-third of the 329 times that Toronto officers deployed tasers, that includes showing its current, firing the darts, and pressing it against a person, involved emotionally disturbed persons, the report states. Blair told the report the term doesn't necessarily refer to a mentally ill person, but to irrational, angry, and violent behavior. It is a perception, he said, not a diagnosis. While the report concludes, quote, few of those classified as emotionally disturbed were apprehended under the Mental Health Act. Board members want more detailed statistics. Board members have raised the issue of taser transparency several times in the past, but they decided yesterday to leave specific changes to the report up to Chief Blair and Board Chair Alok Mukherjee. This from Joanna Furketich in The Spectator. I have no date. St. Joe's closes 26 chronic care beds. St. Joseph's Healthcare is cutting 26 of its hospital beds for the chronically ill and disabled to balance the budget. Closing a third of the hospital's 76 complex continuing care beds saves $1.5 million a year as St. Joseph's battles a $12 million deficit. The city is already short chronic complex care beds used for people with chronic conditions who need more care than nursing homes or home care can provide, with between 70 and 80 people on a wait list at any time. St. Peter's, which has the city's other 250 chronic complex care beds, is already overloaded and can't expand. Winnie Doyle, Vice President of Clinical Programs at St. Joseph's, said the hospital decided to cut the beds because it doesn't have enough nurses to staff them. It's chronically short 3 to 4 nurses in chronic complex care and was using overtime and expensive temp nurses to staff the beds. We've had a very strong recruiting program in nursing here at St. Joe's, and despite that, we haven't been able to attract sufficient staff, Doyle said. St. Joseph's expects to take about 18 months to close the beds. And by Emily Mathieu in the Toronto Star, March the 27th. The name is Cheryl Smith, and she's on Ontario Disability Support Program. What's in the budget for her? I'm worried. What does Mr. McGinty want me to do? There seems like there's nothing for me as a single woman living on ODSP with cancer, with nothing to eat. Cheryl Smith, who relies on the ODSP to pay her bills, found the budget disappointing. What I'm concerned about is Mr. McGinty kept mentioning the $1,000 payments for families. He kept saying families, not single adults, the single 53-year-old said. In fact, Smith qualifies for $300 transitional sales tax benefit coming in 3 installments starting next June. After that, she would get an additional $160 from the new permanent sales tax credit. Smith, who is fighting breast cancer, said the 2% boost for people receiving government support is not enough. She also does not understand why corporations would get relief before people living in poverty. What Smith wanted to see was a healthy food credit for $100. Once she pays the rent and her basic bills with the roughly $1,100 a month she gets from ODSP, including a transportation allowance, she has no money for food or can afford only low-quality food. Smith, who lives in private housing, cannot afford to live alone, so she has roommates. For a person who is ill, she says the situation is very stressful. She had hoped for an immediate rent supplement for people in her situation. Again from the Star, Monday, April 6th, schools fail kids needing special ed, mom says. Following the rules does not work, is the message MPPs must examine. Tina Bowen followed the rules as she fought for school supports to help her son cope with his learning disabilities. After 4 years, the Ajax mother felt abandoned by the public school system and gave up. His spirit was being sucked out of him with all he had to endure in a system that doesn't work, his mother says. Teachers regularly didn't read her son's education plan or apply it if they did, she says. The boy was humiliated by being asked to read aloud in class, scolded for not taking notes. His computer and software, his lifelines for learning, were routinely used, adjusted, and disabled by other students. 2 years ago, the family enrolled him in a private school for kids with special learning needs. He is in grade 8, working hard and learning, and his confidence is back. This year, he ran for class president. Bowen's story echoes those from many frustrated parents across the province whose children have been identified with learning disabilities or other conditions affecting the way they learn, but who can't get the supports they have a legal right to. Hurting but not lashing out yet. March 27th, Carol Gore, The Star. Anger is seldom people's first response to an economic crisis. They worry. They cut back. They absorb life-changing losses, and they wait. As long as governments make an honest effort to provide relief and leadership, businesses display enlightened self-interest, unions behave responsibly, and no one grabs an oversized piece of the shrinking pie, people will show remarkable tolerance. But if anyone breaks these rules, things can get ugly. So far, no one in Canada has crossed the line. Prime Minister Stephen Harper has been insensitive at times. A handful of employers have treated their workers shabbily, and a few public sector unions have been bullheaded. But there haven't been any egregious missteps. In the United States, the situation is more volatile. The titans of Wall Street still don't appear to get it. They are adamant that AIG had a contractual obligation to pay huge bonuses. It evidently doesn't trouble them that the recipients of these payouts lost staggering amounts of money and put the global financial system at risk, nor does it appear to violate their code of ethics to use taxpayers' money, collected from people who've lost their jobs, homes, and savings, to finance unearned corporate bonuses. The business, quote, experts who keep popping up in the media aren't helping matters. Their tone is condescending. Their message is that people should get their priorities straight. Do they want vengeance or do they want to get out of this mess? It's one or the other, they insist. Americans have to choose. Little wonder public outrage is at a combustible level. The border will not act as a firewall. Despite Canada's enviably stable banks, fiscal rectitude, and resource wealth, the economy is faltering. People feel victimized and powerless. If there are early lessons to draw from this recession, they might be these. Patronizing people is ill-advised. They may be unfamiliar with the complexities of global finance, but they know what greed and exploitation look like. Shrugging off public resentment or telling people to get over it won't work. It will only fuel their sense of injustice. Assuming North Americans want to return to 90s-style growth would be a mistake. The majority didn't benefit from the last economic boom. As the pain deepens, Canadians are watching, waiting, making reasonable allowances. They are treating the nation's politicians and financiers better than they were treated. And let's go out with Johnny Big Moose Walker. Would you, baby?
you'd like to be aware a day or two in advance of what the disrespect topic is, if we know a day or two in advance, we'll email you. But you have to email us first. Dialogue@inbox.com. dialogue@inbox.com. For your update on what's coming on Disrespect. Disrespect is streamed live at http://cfmu.mcmaster.ca. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime, Thursdays at noon, 93.3 FM, CFMU, to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.